From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump says Attorney General Jeff Sessions should intervene and stop the Mueller investigation. Sessions recused himself from involvement in the Russia investigation. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was the one who appointed Mueller as special counsel. The president continues to call the investigation a witch hunt. How are his fellow Republicans responding? We'll find out after the news.
KBCC podcasts are supported by SoCal Gas, offering rebates for solar water heating. It works with a customer's existing natural gas water heater to offer reliable and efficient hot water. Invite the strength of the sun into your home or business. Info at SoCalGas.com/solar.
Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a great start to your day, keeping cool despite the heat. Whether you're listening at 89.3 or the KPCC app, we're so pleased to have you with us. Coming up, the future of subscription movie going. Pioneering company MoviePass once offered unlimited movie theater admissions for $10 a month. Those days are gone, but is there still a future for monthly movie passes? We'll look at the industry and what the movie pass effect has been on attendance, concession sales, and more. First, President Trump tweeted this morning that Attorney General Jeff Sessions should stop the Mueller investigation. The president continued to refer to the Russia probe as a rigged witch hunt. Sessions recused himself from any role in the special counsel's investigation, citing a potential conflict of interest. Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was the one who appointed Mueller as special counsel. Now, how is the president's effort to interfere in the investigation being received by fellow Republicans? Joining us, Politico's congressional reporter, Kyle Cheney. Kyle, good to have you with us.
Good to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
This is not in isolation, of course. It's part of a series of heavy criticism and tweets the president's put out against the Mueller investigation. But this is the first time specifically I recall him saying that the attorney general should step in and bring this to a halt. How's this being received?
Sure, you're right that it is the most aggressive he's been. He's never specifically called out Jeff Sessions, said you should do X, and X in this case being the ending this probe altogether. Capitol Hill, is the Republicans on the House side in particular are mostly quiet. They've actually scattered for their August recess, and I think at an opportune time so they can't be cornered to be asked about this. It's Democrats who have come out and said, look, he's trying to obstruct this investigation. There's proof he's doing it right out in the open. And so they're making a lot of noise today.
We also have had the comments by the president about Paul Manafort, NPR News, just detailing those and the references to Al Capone and the treatment of Manafort. What's the sense of the potential for this setting the scene for a pardon for Manafort should he be convicted?
That's always been a fear of people who are supportive of the Mueller investigation, that the president, he went through a bit of a phase where he was pardoning well-known people who were favorites of conservatives and suggested that they had been unfairly prosecuted. And that's the same rationale he's using to criticize the prosecution of Paul Manafort. But there's more personal risk to him if he gets involved and takes actions like such as issuing a pardon here, because it will be viewed through the lens of trying to protect himself from the ongoing investigation. So it's a different calculus, but there is a fear that he could just decide he's fed up and pull the plug.
It's also interesting that the president has referenced all the previous administrations with whom Manafort had dealings, and then tweeted something to the effect, well, why wasn't I warned that he was under investigation? Which is sort of an interesting distancer from the man he chose to actually run his campaign.
Right. It's a little bit discordant in the sense that he's saying, well, look, this guy was well-respected in Republican circles, but then I should have been told if he was being investigated by law enforcement and he wasn't such a good guy. You know, it's just it's kind of a confusing position that he's taking here. And you, as a private citizen, as a candidate, you wouldn't be informed of an ongoing investigation of that nature, most likely.
Now, Rudy Giuliani, the president's attorney, has said the president wasn't giving an order in that tweet. He just used the term should for the attorney general, should end the Russia probe, not must end it. I find it fascinating, Kyle. We've got, you know, Giuliani seems like he's on TV daily. He's responding. We've got the president tweets on this. I mean, it's just unprecedented, all the different voices weighing in with commentary as all these events unfold. And again, are people just sort of in shock on Capitol Hill with how this plays out?
To the extent there is a legal strategy from the Trump side, it is that. It's to blanket the airwaves, it's to never be caught flat-footed or never to be not commenting on developments in this case. It creates a sort of haze and hail of different opinions. And that argument that the president's legal team is putting out now is his tweets are just opinions. They're not necessarily directives. Is a point of some controversy and debate here about whether officials should be listening to those tweets. So that's the fact that they're taking that position just adds to the confusion. And again, does confuse lawmakers, too, who don't really know how to respond.
Kyle, thanks for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
Anytime. Glad to be here.
Okay, thanks. Kyle Chaney, congressional reporter for Politico on 89.3 KPCC. What sounded too good to be true? $9.95 a month. You could see unlimited movies, any theater, anywhere. And, you know, how could you beat that for the price of a single admission? You'd essentially get unlimited movies. Well, MoviePass, according to its numbers, has 3 million subscribers now across the United States. But it's been a tough week for MoviePass as they have changed their terms of service and their offerings as a result of financial pressures on the company. Question is, does the monthly subscription system point to the future of movie going, or is there not a solid economic model for providing those kinds of savings to moviegoers? With us is Ryan Fonder, entertainment business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
So give us a sense of the effect that MoviePass has had on the industry. They're claiming 3 million members. That's not an extraordinary number, but it seems like they're having a big effect on attendance.
Well, it's hard to say how much effect they've actually had on attendance or whether their boosts have been incremental or not. But it is safe to say that MoviePass has grown extraordinarily well over the past year or so. Before they reduced the price from $30 to $10 a month, they only had about 20,000 subscribers. So to reach 3 million, and you know they were also projecting to hit 5 million by the end of the year, that's just exponential growth.
The advantage for movie theaters is apparently they get paid in full for the ticket. MoviePass pays the full amount for their subscriber, and then they get all the proceeds from the concession stand. So, you know, why is it that movie theaters, you know, the chains have had kind of a mixed view of MoviePass?
Well, I mean, some of the movie theaters have had more than a mixed view. They've been vocally, adamantly against MoviePass because their view is that getting people used to going to the movies for an extraordinarily cheap rate will devalue the movie-going experience. And if MoviePass does eventually go out of business, those people who are used to paying almost nothing will now not go at all.
All right. So it's unrealistic expectation, although you could argue, well, maybe they'll, you know, get in the habit of going more to attend. The other thing, I hear a lot of criticism about the price of movie tickets, but I was just looking at the inflation adjustment for what, you know, cost to go to the movies, say, in 1980 versus today. And there's been a little outpacing of inflation, but not a huge amount. And when you factor in the types of movies that people now typically see, you know, first-run films at theaters versus the old ticket price that was averaged across second-run theaters and, you know, kind of stuff people see now on Netflix or Amazon Prime, seems to me that it's pretty much in line historically. Why the perception that movie tickets are so expensive?
Well, because people, if you're going with a family of four, and if you're in a city like Los Angeles, and if you're going for an experience like IMAX, or you're buying popcorns and concessions, and if you're going through, you know, these new amenities that they have, like recliner seating and dine-in theaters and all of that, I mean, it's not cheap to go to the movies anymore. I mean, it's cheaper than going to a concert or a football game, but it is starting to creep up, and people are definitely noticing. And, you know, ever since the recession, people are more price conscious about this kind of thing. And it's pretty clear that the theater owners have been, you know, progressively increasing prices and amenities in order to make up for the stagnation in actual attendance at the theater. So you definitely are seeing an effect there.
We're talking with LA Times entertainment business reporter Ryan Fonder. My question for you as an AirTalk listener is, what do you think is a model that would make sense to make movie going more affordable and that would be realistic? And would it make sense for theater chains themselves to offer monthly passes in a way that, you know, gets people into the theaters, buying concessions, gets them used to more frequent movie attendance, but would still work economically? And what do you think the price point would be? I mean, it seems $10 a month pretty unrealistic for unlimited movie going, and MoviePass as much as admitting that. They've already now put off limits some of the most popular releases, like the most recent Mission Impossible. That's not included in the opening weekend anymore, and some of the screening times are no longer included, the most popular ones covered under MoviePass. What do you think is a model that would make sense, and at what price point would you be willing to buy a pass? 866-893-KP ECC 866-893-5722 or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me, the president of our own local movie theater chain, Lemley Theaters, Greg Lemley. Greg, good to have you with us again.
A pleasure being here, Larry. Thank you for having me.
What kind of effect has MoviePass had on attendance at your theaters?
We see about 5% of ticket sales going to MoviePass. It's hard to see exactly because, as you noted earlier, basically they are just buying a general admission ticket. So unless the cashier is diligent in, you know, punching out a separate ticket type, we can't see exactly. But that's about the number. I don't know that it's bringing in more moviegoers, but people are seeing movies more frequently.
But since the movie pass, you have to get paid by them for a subscriber's admission, right? So when a movie pass card is given at one of your box offices, doesn't the ticket taker indicate you have to put it in as such, so you then get reimbursed by movie pass?
We're essentially paid right on the spot as if they were using their credit card.
I see. Okay. Almost like a MoviePass debit card, in a sense.
Correct.
Okay. Okay. And you don't track that necessarily separately?
We ask our cashiers to track it separately because we did want to see what the impact was, but I can't say that every MoviePass ticket automatically gets rung up in that fashion.
What's the downside for you, if there is one, of a MoviePass customer?
I'm honestly not sure that there is a downside other than that long-term question of whether or not it devalues the movie-going experience or leads the, you know, patrons to sort of a misunderstanding about the basic way that the finances flow when they buy a ticket. You know, we don't own the content. We don't know, you know, we license the film from the studios and from the distributors. And the expectation is that we are selling tickets individually. So we have a transactional, you know, basis to our contract, really, with the content provider. So in any subscription service, we would still need to pay the content owner, you know, per transaction.
All right. Again, I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. What do you think would make sense for a subscription model for films? If the movie pass $10 a month for unlimited movie going isn't reasonable, isn't sustainable, that the company, you know, can't exist at that low monthly fee or without serious restrictions on what a moviegoer can see, what is the sweet spot? I'd like to hear from you. 866-893-KPEC. 866-893-5722. And do you think it's feasible to have a subscription model for movie going? Is that one of the best ways of people building up the habit of going to theaters and doing it in a more affordable way? Is it a win-win for exhibitors as well as for moviegoers? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And speaking of movies, we have limited tickets available to see Chinatown at the Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, this Saturday night. I'll be hosting the screening. Our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, will be there to talk about Chinatown afterwards. And we'll also be joined by the great screenwriter Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown. He joins us on stage after the film. Tickets at kpecc.org/in-person, part of our Film Week screening series of movies set in Los Angeles. We'll be back with more about the subscription movie-going model in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. I'd be so interested in knowing, when it comes to what Americans spend on visual entertainment, if it's really much different than in years past, once you factor in television subscriptions, Netflix, Amazon Prime, live theater admissions, concert going. You know, how much of this is really different? I mean, even concerts are a visual experience, often as much, if not more, than they are an auditory experience. How does that compare? We're talking about the future of movie going and the subscription model, whether that's workable or not. 866-893-KPECC. A number of listeners have talked about exhibitors themselves coming up with unlimited passes. Greg Lemley's the president of Lemley Theaters, which is an expanding Southern California art house chain. They have new theaters opened in Glendale, others that are going into the San Gabriel Valley. They have mainstream films they show at some locations in addition to art house fare. Greg, I know you have some sort of like a rewards thing for frequent moviegoers. Have you considered an unlimited admission pass, I don't know, maybe $20 a month, something like that, that would spur additional admissions, help you sell more concessions, but that you wouldn't go broke on?
Well, I think that's the question mark, is whether or not you'll go broke. The only way you're not going to go broke is if people are not using it as frequently as they think, in which case you're still making, you know, the amount that you need to make to cover the licensing fees that you have to pay to the distributor, or you're making money in some other way. And, you know, one of the big promises of MoviePass to its investors was that they were going to do a lot of data mining. You know, that's not a business that I want to be in, and I'm not sure that it's a business I want my customers to be exposed to. Our plan is to, you know, just be more aggressive with our transactional discounting. So you mentioned we have a Premier card. You can get $3 off tickets every time you buy it if you use your Premier card instead of using a debit card or some other, you know, method of payment. We have voucher programs. We discount for certain parts of the day or for certain, you know, audience members. Seniors get a great discount, you know, if they come to a midweek matinee. So I think, look, what MoviePass showed is that there is some price sensitivity on this matter, but I don't know that you necessarily need to upend, you know, the way the exhibition has been.
I also wonder what your thought is, Greg, on the people that use MoviePass, if they're the most price sensitive segment of the movie going market. Is it also safe to assume they're the least likely to buy concessions or the lowest spenders for concessions?
You know, it's interesting on that point, because, again, one of the thoughts was that, you know, people were spending more at concessions, and we did not see that. Now, there were more people in the theater, but, you know, the amount spent per patron was roughly still in line, which seems to indicate that they were like other moviegoers. You know, it did not move the needle in that regard.
Are you saying they spent the same per person? Then that would benefit you,
not
right?
Not see our per capita numbers changed during this entire experiment.
Okay. All right. Also with us, Ryan Fonder, entertainment business reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Greg Lemley just mentioned that MoviePass's idea was apparently they lose money on the admissions to theaters through the subscribers, but they have this rich pool of data that they can sell, I don't know, to studios or whoever that would use it. I'm trying to figure out what value that data would hold that would lead someone to pay MoviePass significantly for access to it. Has MoviePass explained what the value would be?
Not really. And if you ask the studios what the value is, they really question it as well, which is why you don't see all that many studios and film distributors actually taking MoviePass up on its offer and partnering for data. I mean, studios can get data elsewhere. They would like to get data directly from the exhibitors, but that's not happening that much right now. And then you have all this consumer sensitivity, like Greg mentioned, and a really good point to this data mining question, especially after the Cambridge Analytica scandal. So that sort of hasn't panned out the way that MoviePass had anticipated.
Let's talk with Joshua in Downey. Joshua, what's your idea for how a subscription model might work for movie admissions?
One of the things I'm surprised by is that they don't have a tiered system. So say that you want to pay $15 a month on the lowest end for MoviePass, but you have to accept, you know, that you can only go during non-peak times and such. Or maybe you want to go during those peak times or premieres, and I'd be willing to pay more money for that type of service.
Yeah, that's a great point. So, you know, a student, for example, who might have a flexible schedule, maybe can go during the day, catch an afternoon showing, and you know, save some money that way. No, that's a really good point. Ryan Fonder of the LA Times, has this been discussed, a tiered subscription model?
I haven't heard about that one, but MoviePass did try what's called surge pricing, which is to get people to pay a little bit more for more popular films. Again, the idea was a little half-baked and not communicated that great to consumers, so that also caused a bit of online outrage. Part of the problem with MoviePass is that its business model doesn't appear to be that well thought out. Maybe it took off a little faster than they thought it would. But that's one that I haven't heard, but it's an interesting idea.
Well, and I think it's very different. What I like about Joshua's suggestion is you're still paying the full amount up front, and you know what the limitations are up front. What MoviePass tried to do with the surge pricing psychologically is very different. It's like, what? You're asking me to pay $2 or $3 more to go see? Wait, I've already paid. It could net out the same, but it doesn't feel the same, I think, to the consumer. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. David joins us from Gilbert, Arizona. You're on AirTalk. What do you think, David?
I just got involved in an AMC program, and I think it's chain-wide through the nation, but it's called the A-List. For $20 a month, I get to go 3 movies per week in a given month. And it's not limited to the type of format. I can go to a big screen, a small screen, brand new release. I just saw Mission Impossible.
And it doesn't limit the showing times you can use it?
No, almost any time of the day.
Wow.
I double-checked all of that, thinking I was limited somehow. But now they said, no, you can just come on in 3 times a week, and you're good for it.
Which is essentially unlimited. Who has time for more than 3 movies? Oh, wait, that's great. So $20 a month. Well, that's kind of what I was talking about. And AMC being a big enough chain that if that's your local movie theater, that could work. So, David, for you, does that cover all your movie going?
That pretty much would. I can't see seeing more than 3 a week as it is, hardly, but
yeah.
I'm going to do my best for the summer.
Yeah, you're almost into film critic territory. Hey, David, thanks so much, and great to have you listening in Arizona. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page. Greg Lemley, president of Lemley Theaters, have you considered perhaps joining with some of the larger exhibition chains and coming up with an exhibitor-run subscription model?
It's an interesting question. I'm not necessarily adverse to it, but look, we're a small company, and we're not going to be on the leading edge of a lot of this stuff. When there was the digital transition from film projection to digital, you know, we went along. We were not part of a conversation about how that was going to be structured, and some aspects of it were, you know, not helpful to, you know, independent exhibitors and distributors. But you know, that's where the industry was going, and we went along. So we'll be open to different ideas that come along. But, you know, having us affiliated with AMC is sort of like having a craft brewer affiliated with Coors. It just doesn't quite work.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Let's talk with Dara in Pasadena. You're on Air Talk.
Yeah, I have a 19-year-old that's home for the summer who's used MoviePass 2 to 3 times a week. And even he's expressed, like, how can they do this?
Yeah, you don't need an MBA to question the economics of it. But it sounds like he's really enjoying having it available.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's not too much 19-year-olds can do. They're in between being 21 and a teenager. And so it's provided an outlet for him and his friends. And he expressed that he would actually pay more.
How high do you think your son might be willing to go for unlimited movie going? How much a month?
During the summer, he would probably do $25. I think once he got back to school, he goes to school in rural Iowa, so it probably wouldn't be helpful. He'd probably just cancel it, or I don't know how it works. But during the summer, he'd definitely pay at least $25 a month.
All right, Dara, thanks so much. I appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Alex in Long Beach, what model do you think would work?
Hi, I think the model of, you know, elevating the prices a little bit is definitely within reason, because like everybody's been saying, it's pretty unanimous that everybody definitely understands that $10 for unlimited movie watching is quite generous, to say the least. And to enhance on Dara's opinion a little bit earlier, $25 is definitely reasonable, but I would try to think something around the lines of like $15, $20 a month. That way you're paying a price that you're really not too concerned about canceling, you know, during seasonal periods or anything like that.
Yeah. All right, Alex, I appreciate it. Greg Lemley, you have to be concerned that, you know, whatever that supposed sweet spot is, that if it's too generous, it cannibalizes your full price customers. Do you have a sense of where that dollar amount might be?
I really don't. I mean, ultimately, because if people are seeing 10 movies a month, you know, certainly, you know, $120, that's going to be too much, you know, but even at $60, they're coming at half price. And again, we have to pay the distributor of the film for that admission.
And yeah. Not,
you know, and if that number drops too low, especially for popular Hollywood films, we're actually, again, going to be coming out of pocket. So you're always going to be asking the question, how are we making up that difference? Is it increased concessions? Well, certainly, at least at our theaters, we didn't see that. Is it, you know, and you come back to, you know, that question of the value of data mining, being able to track consumer trends. And again, now you're in a different business.
Yeah. And when you look at the AMC pass, what, $20 or whatever we heard that was, do you think that's going to be sustainable for them?
I have have no idea.
Yeah, but I mean, the point you raised that they still have to pay
to get people away from MoviePass.
Yeah,
to the extent that that was predatory in some respects. You know, who knows? But they've thrown down a marker on that number. Whether they can sustain it or not, that'll be, you know, that'll be their decision.
Hey, Greg, thank you for being game to talk about this. We really appreciate it. Thanks very much.
Sure.
Greg Lemley is the president of Lemley Theaters, Southern California-based art house and general movie fair. Also want to share from MoviePass, they declined to join us for the conversation, but their CEO, Mitch Lowe, says over the past several days, we've begun making the necessary changes to our service that will help us continue to offer our members a high-value, low-cost in-theater movie experience. These are essential steps to continue providing the most attractive subscription service in the industry. Our community of more than 3 million members has shown an immense amount of enthusiasm over the past year, and we trust they will continue to share our vision to reinvigorate the movie industry. Thanks so much, Ryan Fonder, entertainment business reporter for the LA Times. Good to have you with us as well. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. We have much more to come right after a live update from Hedy Lyn Herdes. Great to have you with us today on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, you know those signs that you see around infrastructure projects? This brought to you through, you know, Bond A money or, you know, touting your tax dollars at work and the like. Well, there's criticism by opponents of the California gasoline tax that, since that's going to be voted on in a referendum in November, that you've got all these signs up where highway construction and improvements going on. They say that's unfair. It's like politicking on the infrastructure site. We'll talk about that coming up in the second hour. But first, you know the advice that we often hear given to young people? Find that thing you really love, that you're passionate about, and then find a way to make a living in that, and it's not like you're really working. Well, that advice might be questionable, according to researchers at Stanford University, as well as Yale and NUS College in Singapore. With us to talk about the study Implicit Theories of Interest, Finding Your Passion or Developing It, is Gregory M. Walton. The study is in a forthcoming edition of Psychological Science, and Professor Walton is Associate Professor of Psychology at Stanford University. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you for having me.
So you draw a distinction here between sort of finding a passion as though that we're all born with one and cultivating it. So describe how your study gets to that distinction.
Yeah, so we did a several different studies within this paper. One of the studies simply asked people to what extent they think of passions as things that are innate and fixed that you just have versus things that are cultivated and developed. In that study, the participants who are college students had also self-identified as being what at Stanford are called techies or fuzzies. Techies, people interested in technical fields. Fuzzies, people interested in the humanities. And then we gave everybody a couple of different stories to read, a couple of different articles to read, one from the humanities and one from the sciences. And what we found was that everybody was interested in the article that fell within their area. So the people who were interested in the humanities, the fuzzies, were interested in the article from the humanities. And the people who were techies were interested in the article from the sciences. But there was a difference in how interested people were in the article outside their area. And that difference was predicted by the extent to which they endorsed the theory that interests are fixed versus developed. So if people thought that interests were fixed, they were less interested in the story outside their area.
Might that be, though, because it's not the view that leads to that, but that's sort of just how they're wired, that they are from the beginning a more fixed interest type.
Yeah, so those kinds of people could differ for lots of different reasons. So we did another study then where we manipulated whether people in that moment were thinking about interests as things that can develop or things that are fixed, and we found of results, so that people who in the moment were led to think of interests as things that can develop were then more open to and interested in an article outside their interest area. The techies became interested in the thing from the humanities, and the fuzzies became interested in the scientific article. So we know it's not something sort of hardwired in them. We know that belief system or that way of thinking about interest has a causal effect.
There are some people who just seem almost to, from birth, have a very strong sense of who they are in the world. Their personality is strong, their interest, the things they gravitate toward. And so the sort of finding passion seems almost automatic. And then for other people, it seems that sort of sense of who they are, that sense of identity is sort of squishier, for lack of a better term. And they're not quite clear to even themselves, sort of who they are, what interests them all. So how much of this is just talking about almost innate differences in personality?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, it's true that people differ in many ways. And for some people have an easier time developing interests and finding passions than other people. That's certainly true. But it's also true that if you are thinking about interests as things that are fixed, then that changes how you do that work for yourself. For example, it makes you less open to areas outside of those already self-defined areas of interest.
I hear. So what are the implications educationally, do you think, for young people who are getting advice on educational goals or career goals? What is a better way, do you think, to encourage them to find the right fit?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that advice, find your interest, find your passion, is almost always very well-intended advice. It can be helpful for people. Often I think schools, colleges, universities, administrators, they look at their offerings within their institution and they say, wow, we have 55 different academic departments. We have 4 different schools. There are so many opportunities for people to learn and develop here. And then they say, find your interest. And it's meant to be empowering for people. And it's also better than in some ways what we used to say, which was sort of find your genius or find your strength, which was very intimidating because it meant that it made it seem like you had to be some brilliant person to be able to pursue a field. Everybody can have an interest. But for people who are actually in that circumstance, for the students who are actually coming into a school setting, like a college setting, and looking at that array of spaces, it makes it sound like what you're to do as a student is to go from place to place, like lecture to lecture, class to class, and wait for the extraordinary excitement and enthusiasm and passion and endless motivation to wash over you, to be moved by the space. And I think a better way to think about it for a student is that that student has agency, and what they're doing is they're developing themselves, they're investing in themselves, and they're going from place to place, they're learning about different areas, they're trying things out for size, they're constantly evaluating and reevaluating. And they're making a decision about those investments that they're putting into themselves. And part of that process, it can be assumed, is going to be difficult and challenging. So there are going to be times where people struggle, where people have difficulties, where the work is frustrating, where you take maybe you become interested in astrophysics, and then you take an astrophysics class that captivates you, but then a later class is very difficult and challenging. And it's to be expected that in that process of self-development, those challenges will occur. And what a person is doing as they're going through that is they're developing and investing in themselves.
Well, it's interesting because even when it comes to majors in college or graduate fields of study, for myself, I changed major when I was in college. I started 2 different graduate programs. I sort of felt like it was part of the process. And for myself, I didn't really feel a sense of failure. Just sort of, okay, I've learned that about myself. Now go kind of in this other direction. Do you think institutionally we make that unnecessarily hard?
I think that there are certainly circumstances where students feel like there is some stigma around changing their major as though that means that there's been a mistake. And I think that that's just not valid. I mean, I think lots of people, you know, what adolescence is and what young adulthood is in many ways is a process of exploring the wider world beyond your you know, home community and home family, learning about yourself and how it interacts with that world. And people should, you know, go full front into that exploration process.
We're talking with Stanford University Associate Professor of Psychology Gregory M. Walton. He's the co-author of a study published in an upcoming edition of Psychological Science, which looks at the advice often given to follow your passion, to find this passion, this strong drive that everybody supposedly has, and to make that your work. I'm interested in hearing your thoughts about that, this study, a critique of that approach. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. You know, it's one thing to have a passion, to follow it, or to find something that you're deeply invested in emotionally that gives you pleasure and fulfillment. It's another to have it in a way that society values it enough to pay you for it. I mean, this is the dilemma of the artist, right? Is, you know, most people who do art for a living don't make a living at it and have to do other things as well. All of this factors in to the kinds of trade-offs, the decisions that we make in our professional and academic lives. We're getting at some of these issues in a new Stanford study done with other institutions like Yale. Gregory M. Walton of Stanford joining us to talk about theories of interest and the kind of advice we give people over finding what they care deeply about, what they're emotionally invested in. Tom in Santa Ana, you're on Air Talk. What do you think?
Yeah, I found, I'm an engineer, and in my experience, I found that people tend to gravitate towards what they're good at, what they're interested in, and it naturally happens. For example, you might a young person might go into engineering because they hear they can get a good job, a decent paying job, but once they're in there, they might find that engineering's not quite for them, and they're more of a people person, so they might go into management of engineers. Or they might decide that they want to go become a patent attorney, and they'll get a law degree. So, you know, people tend to gravitate towards what they're good at. But it's good. So that saying of finding your passion and interest, I think, is kind of half right. You know, you should be in an area that you can support yourself. And then once you're there, though, then you gravitate towards what you really like.
Yeah. No, I think that makes a lot of sense, Tom. And then, you know, the other part of this is that I think often in the follow your passion advice was a sort of antidote to earlier advice people would get, is sort of, you know, look for a good paying job that's going to be stable, that's going to, you know, that sort of advice of the old days. And so you just suck it up, you work the assembly line or, you know, whatever it is you need to do to support yourself and your family. And it didn't really matter whether you liked it or not, you just had to tolerate it. So I get the idea of the follow your passion. I think you do a great job of laying out that's just sort of the start. It's the yes, but it's the and that takes us beyond that. Professor Walton, your thoughts on Tom's observation?
Yeah, I think the idea that it's half right is interesting. It's important for people to pursue the things that do intrigue them, that are that there's a kernel of interest developed there. But I think it's important that in the process of doing that, what you understand yourself is doing is as developing an interest or a passion, not just as expecting it to, you know, be fully born at the moment that you begin it. If you think that if you go into engineering and you think that engineering is your passion, and then engineering becomes difficult and frustrating and challenging, it's easy to drop it as though it was never really your passion in the first place. But if you understand yourself as developing that passion, it gives you the resilience to keep going and to develop in that space.
All right. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Nate in Cerritos, welcome.
Hey, Larry, I wanted to comment because my passion for a long time was pinball machine restoration and and I ended up opening up my own business to do just that and make some money on that. Well, I ended up seeing another side of the business that I hadn't seen when it was a hobby, and I ended up hating it. You know, I didn't like having to live up to expectations of customers and have to deal with warranty issues and things like that. And it turned my passion into a job, really, is what I felt like. And so I see the, you know, the meaning behind the saying, but I think that depending on what you're getting into, it can really turn the opposite way.
Nate, I'm so glad you raised that issue. When I was young and I was looking at potentially going into broadcasting, and I went and I visited people who worked in the business and you know interviewed them and got there, they all seemed to hate their job so much it scared me about going into broadcasting, because I thought, well, if everybody hates it and they all have disdain for their audience and think everybody's an idiot who listens to them, gosh, you know, why would I want to do this? And it kind of scared me off. These were people who at some point, I assume, loved it and ended up having contempt for the people that paid their salaries and hated the job. And that was kind of an eye-opening experience. Fortunately, I have a very different one, and I have to tone down my enthusiasm when I talk with young people who ask me about the business. But great point. What you're passionate about and care about can become a burden. Dan in Brea, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to comment. I'm entering my 20th year in public education, and I certainly didn't know that back in, you know, the year 2000, that this was going to be my passion. I graduated from college with a Spanish degree and thought, what are you going to do? Well, I guess I may as well teach. And I never thought that I would, you know, the difference between, you know, as a student, I love school, but there's a huge difference between receiving a high quality education versus the art and the science and everything that goes into delivering it. So for 15 years as a teacher, I cultivated that, and I've dealt primarily with students. And now entering my fifth year as an administrator, I don't deal so much with students. I deal with, you know, 200 unionized employees, and it is a totally different aspect to education, and I'm finding the passion for it. I certainly don't
Yeah.
as much as I did teaching. There's not the immediate satisfaction, but I'm starting to love the administrative side.
That's great.
Too.
And you wouldn't have known that before. Dan, thank you so much. Ashley in Long Beach. Ashley, you want to talk about how your millennial generation, how this message has been received?
Yeah. Hi, Larry. I was calling because I think that our generation, so I'm part of the millennial generation, and I think that we've been kind of sold on this idea that we need to follow our passions and find a job that we love. And I really feel like that's led to the rise of the gig economy, where we don't have worker protected rights and, you know, steady employment anymore. And that's kind of my perspective on it. I think that it's not something that most people are able to do. And so now, you know, I think it's something like 25% of our employment group is participating in the gig economy in some way or has some kind of a side hustle. And I don't know what the long-term effects of that are going to be.
Yeah, it's a really good point, Ashley. Appreciate your call. Professor Walton, your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think that the idea of finding your passion, it's not necessarily that your passion is going to be what you're going to earn a living from. The idea at a higher level is that our lives have value when we're engaged in activities that are meaningful to us. And part of that involves, obviously, the more that can, you know, coincide with paying the bills, the better.
Yeah.
Part of that also involves, you know, how we make sense of the day-to-day experiences that we have in a work setting. So, you know, when we have undergraduate research assistants, we tell undergraduate research assistants, look, a lot of the work that you're going to do is going to be boring and going to be calling participants.
But there is a payoff, hopefully down the road. Professor Walton, good to have you with us. Thank you so much. He joins us from Stanford University. Much more to come in the second hour of Air Talk. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a terrific day. Coming up later this hour, take a look at the future of Mars. Will it be possible for humans to colonize the planet? Well, maybe some bigger impediments than we'd even thought. We'll talk about that. And also, the California water land development history that's told in the story of Chinatown, the classic film we're showing Saturday night at Theater at Ace Hotel. We're going to talk about the real history with the Department of Water and Power's historian. That's coming up later this hour. But first, we turn our attention to a call from California State Senator Lingling Chang of Diamond Bar to remove the signs on the road improvement projects that show the improvements are being funded by California's recent gas tax increase. Now, it's nothing new for state infrastructure projects to have signs on them, you know, saying that this is made possible by measure such and such funds or by such and such a bond measure. We see that on school sites with local district bonds they credit it. This, of course, all of, you know, trying to build support for any future tax increases that'll come your way to show, yes, the money's actually being spent on something that you can see. But in the case of the gas tax expenditures, State Senator Chang says the problem is that's actually on the upcoming ballot. Californians are going to vote in November whether they want to do away with the gas tax. And so this essentially is political speech by putting a sign on a road project, attributing it to the gas tax revenue. With us to talk about how these signs have been historically used and whether they, you know, really are fair play by government is director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles, Rafe Sun and Shine. Rafe, good to have you with us again.
Be with you, Larry.
You know, like all of it, we've sort of grown up with these signs, gotten pretty used to them, right?
Yeah, although I have to say there's a much greater tradition of this on the East Coast, where I grew up, which is almost every building has a sign that says your tax dollars at work. And I always thought that California should do much more of that. That's a separate item from this current debate. But there's a long-standing tradition going all the way back to the New Deal of reminding people what they voted for or what their elected officials committed of their tax dollars. It shows some results because everybody always complains that the government doesn't do anything useful with their money.
Now, can they do the opposite and put up a sign with the DMV employee who's sleeping at the desk, your tax dollars at work? It would sort of balance it out, right?
I'll let that one go, but that's a funny point. But certainly the public sense of it is people are much more aware of the sleeping employee than of the thing that was built with tax dollars. So it's more of an uphill battle to convince people about that.
Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a call that you're aware of to not put the signs up because of a tax measure that's been on the ballot?
Well, I don't think I've ever heard of that. I mean, I understand the state senator's desire to make this an issue, and it's not a bad issue because going down the road, the bigger issue is going to be how active can a state government be in taking a position on this measure going forward. You know, if they had a sign that said vote no on this proposition, that would be a pretty big deal. The funny thing about this is that the SB1, which was passed in April of 17, is already building things. So you'd have to argue the state should stop doing what it normally would do if there was nothing on the ballot. And that might be a harder case to make. Of course, I'm not making a lawyer's case.
Yeah, no. Just sort of a rational case, yeah. The sign, by the way, says Rebuilding California. That's the name that the state has given for the $5.2 billion project. That's the total amount of new revenues that have come from the tax increase on gasoline and diesel, which went into effect last fall. Should also mention that Senator Chang was the winner of the seat where Democratic State Senator Josh Newman of Fullerton was recalled. Yeah. So this seat has been ground zero for the whole debate over the gas tax. And this became a cause of the Republican Party in California to remove Newman. He was removed. And Lingling Chang is now the state senator holding this seat. So, Rafe, I mean, you've got something that's historic in and of itself, even before the call.
Oh, I think this is really a big deal. In fact, I think a lot of us underestimated the impact of the gas tax in terms of this election, including its potential impact on the House races. a number of which are in Orange County and San Diego, where this may be a mobilizing vote, not only for Republicans, but, you know, the repeal may draw some support from Democrats. It's going to mobilize the whole state government and business and labor to try to protect the gas tax. And I think it's the Newman recall, though, was really an explosive thing that really convinced people that this is a real, this is going to be a real issue going into November.
Rafe Sonnenschein's executive director of the Pat Brown Institute at Cal State LA, also with us from the California Department of Transportation, Caltrans, spokesman Matt Rocco. Thank you, Matt, for being with us.
Good morning, Larry.
Good morning. What is Caltrans policy about posting signs, not just on gas tax projects, but any of the roadway infrastructure projects? Do you always put signs up?
Well, we can actually predate the New Deal. California has been putting signs up since 1928. And it's also been used by our local agencies and other state departments of transportation for decades. One reason is for safety, to let drivers know that there's work ahead. And the second reason is to let the public know how we're investing their tax dollars.
All right. And what is the cost? I saw in the LA Times $700 per sign. Is that accurate for what it costs to put this up?
That is about the average cost of each sign, each SB1 sign.
Okay. So do you have a sense of how many of these signs are up throughout the state?
Well, we've been putting them on all of our active projects. So far, we have about 60 projects statewide that are in construction. I do know that there are each projects that are funded by SB1. There's about 81 projects that have signs right now, and that's stuff that's in construction or about to go into construction.
All right. And what is going to be Caltrans' response? Or are you in the process of drafting the response to the state senator's request?
Well, we are in the process of officially responding to the state senator. But I can just give you the facts. I mean, this is a tremendous impact to the state in terms of this gas tax. It's bringing in about $54 billion over the next 10 years. And that's not only for the state, but half of the money goes to the local cities and counties. So those are the roads that your listeners are driving on right now.
All right. And do you think that it does have an effect on public opinion, having this kind of signage?
Well, what I can say about public opinion, as the professor said, is that we want the public to know how we're using their tax dollars. But the moment SB1 passed in April 2017, Caltrans got to work, and not only Caltrans, but every city and county across the state, to start using these funds. And we want to change the opinion of the public, to let them know that Caltrans and other transportation agencies are at work right now to fix the nearly, or to catch up on the nearly $130 billion of deferred maintenance that's occurred over the last few decades.
I'd love to hear from AirTalk listeners. What do you think about the signs? Do you think it's an appropriate expenditure for Caltrans to spend a few hundred dollars on each of the signs to let people know this is specifically something funded by the gas tax increase? Or do you think that that's not right? We're at 866-893-KPCC or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also with us from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association, VP of Communications, Susan Shelley. Susan, do you think that these signs are justified?
Well, you have to look at two different things. First of all, are these the same kind of signs that have been used elsewhere in California? And the answer is no, they're not. They're different. They don't have the fluorescent orange. They don't have the year of completion. They're not really informational in the same way. They're not really for safety, because they don't have the fluorescent to show you that there's work ahead, because perhaps the work is 6 months ahead. What you have here is a different set of rules about when these signs can be posted. If you go to the Caltrans website and you look up Project Funding ID signs, which is what these are called, you can see that the regular policy has been they only put them on signs with an estimated contract cost of $750,000 or more and 50 working days. But on the SB1 signs, they have a different policy. They are putting them on all SB1 projects, regardless of the contract cost, regardless of the number of workdays. So the first thing is, it's not the same as the other signs. And the second thing is, you have to look at this in the context of what are the rules for public officials making publicly funded communications with constituents. If you go to the FPPC, the Fair Political Practices Commission website, you can see all the rules that when you get close to an election, public officials are not allowed to do mass mailings to their constituents at public expense. There are very specific rules about advertising. Any kind of public fund expenditure that could be connected to a campaign is not legal.
I wonder, though, if you could argue these are neutral. They're not saying, hey, isn't it great, this project, because of the gas tax. Just telling you it's from the gas tax. You can come to your own conclusion if you think this is a project that should have been done, if there should have been other revenues of the state that were used instead of a gas tax increase. So what leads you to interpret the sign as being boosterish?
What was just said by the representative from Caltrans, he said, we want to change the opinion of the public. Right there. They want to change the opinion of the public with your money on a different kind of sign close to an election.
Matt Rocco of Caltrans, can you speak to the issue that Caltrans changed the rules for signage for these specific gas tax projects?
Well, if I may, I want to repeat, the opinion we want to not so much change, but the opinion we want the public to have is that Caltrans and, quite frankly, any other transportation agency in the state is doing whatever it can to take advantage of this funding to take care of $130 billion of back maintenance. But the signs are just simply one part of us educating the public about the projects. If your listeners go to rebuildingca.ca.gov, on there is down to the dollar how we're using these funds to repair the roads, to repair the bridges, to repair the culverts across the state. Again, rebuildingca.ca.gov. So it's part of a concerted effort to let the public know how we're using their tax dollars.
Okay. And also Susan Shelley's argument that this in essence is a communication with constituents that the state is undertaking. You would take issue with that characterization?
I would say, all of California is I work for all the citizens of California. So they have a right to know how their hard-earned tax dollars are being spent and being invested. So my job is to educate them on how and what better way than to have a sign going right by a project that's improving their roadways.
All right. Thank you so much. That's Matt Rocco of Caltrans, Susan Shelley of the Jarvis Taxpayer Association, Rafe Sonnenschein of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State Los Angeles. You can share your thoughts about the challenge to the Caltrans signs indicating specific projects funded by the gas tax increase. The challenge in a letter from State Senator Ling-Ling Chang, the Republican of Diamond Bar, she's asking Caltrans to take down the signs while state voters are considering in November whether to repeal the gas tax increase. Coming up on Air Talk, the future of colonizing Mars. Is it more or less likely, more realistic or less than we thought? We'll talk about that. And again, want to remind you, we are down to limited tickets left to Saturday night screening of Chinatown. It's our next Film Week screening series event, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles. And Saturday night, 7 o'clock screening, tickets at kpcc.org/in-person. The screenwriter of Chinatown, Robert Towne, and our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig, both join me on stage for the post-film conversation. We'll see you Saturday night. I'll be back with you in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. You know, from time to time, we drop in on Mars. I just find it such a fascinating subject area. The idea that humans could potentially colonize Mars. What are the challenges to, you know, transporting humans to the red planet? What sorts of ways could humans survive on the surface? And what would be the incremental steps along the way? Well, we have a couple of interesting areas to discuss in that. One of them having to do with terraforming the planet. What are the obstacles? What are the challenges to humans actually being able to survive on Mars? The other has to do with the whole psychological stressors of such long travel time between Earth and Mars, and what it would mean for individuals leaving on a journey from which they know they would never return. With us, first of all, to talk about the terraforming challenge is Christopher Edwards, professor of planetary science at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff and co-author of the recently published paper Inventory of CO2 Available for Terraforming Mars. Professor Edwards, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So what were your findings in this recent study?
Yeah, so this recent study builds on a long history of Mars exploration carried out by NASA and ESA and other programs like that. And essentially what we did was to total up the inventory of CO2 available, exactly like the title says. And so we looked at a bunch of different reservoirs across the surface where we might have CO2 that could be put into the atmosphere, including reservoirs like polar ice deposits, near-surface carbonate rock deposits, CO2 that might be stuck to the outside of soil, or polar sort of ice clathrates where you've got CO2 stuck in the middle of a water structure. And so we added all these things up and tried to figure out, can these be mobilized using current technology, and what are the implications for that as far as, you know, changing the atmosphere of Mars? And we found that, gee, there's just not enough left on the surface to do that, and most of it has escaped.
And with the belief that there's water, I mean, how much could you use that to generate the essentials for life on Mars?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so you generally don't want a 100% CO2 atmosphere, right? CO2 in our atmosphere is at the parts per million level, and that's kind of where we like it, right? We don't want it to go too much higher. You get significantly warmer climate. And so, you know, CO2 on Mars and water vapor are really the only greenhouse gases likely to be present in sort of significant abundances that could provide this warming. And really what we need to do for Mars is increase the overall pressure. And sort of the baseline for a lot of terraforming discussion is sort of how you can, you know, modify the planet so that humans can survive without pressure suits or without habitats. And so we took that same approach here and said, you know, we would just want to essentially increase the pressure of Mars to make it so that, you know, the pressure was high enough and temperatures were warm enough that water was stable and that humans didn't need, giant pressure suits like we used on the moon.
Are there other alternatives? If the CO2 simply isn't sufficient, is there any way we potentially get around that technologically?
I mean, sure, right? I mean, the baseline we used in this paper was current technology. So could we find enough CO2 that we could sort of release using what we kind of know today? But that's not very in the spirit of science fiction, right? We can always have future technology that changes things. We could produce a bunch of chlorofluorocarbons like freon and really, you know, ramp up the greenhouse effect on Mars. But we wanted to take sort of a realistic approach to what was going to be possible now or sort of in the near term for exploring Mars.
We're talking with Christopher Edwards, Northern Arizona University professor and co-author of the paper that looks at the CO2 available on Mars and whether that would allow for terraforming for humans to be able to colonize the red planet. If you have questions for him, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Also joining us to talk about the psychological challenges of a journey to Mars, given the number of years involved involved is professor at the University of Hawaii and founder of the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation, known as High Seas, Kim Binstead. Professor, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So this is a NASA-funded simulation of a Mars mission. You know, share with us what you're learning from this.
Well, what we're trying to find out is how to keep the human part of a Mars exploration mission running well. So the psychology, both individual and as a group, how to choose people to go on these long-duration missions, and how to support them on the long-duration missions so they stay happy and healthy. Because if the human part of the mission goes wrong, it's just as dangerous as if the rocket blows up.
How do you control for the psychology of the individuals who take part in it? Because the kind of person who's going to volunteer for a time-defined period where they may be cut off from the rest or could escape from it if they needed to, that's maybe very different from the kind of person who commits to a life as an astronaut and you know, is part of something that doesn't have the parameters of this kind of a study. How do you control for that?
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, our mission obviously isn't as dangerous as a mission to Mars and isn't as challenging as a mission to Mars, but it is still quite challenging. And so when we are choosing our crews, we do a lot of psychological profiling, and we look for people who are as astronaut-like as possible in their professional background, in their educational background, and also in their attitude towards danger and life in general.
All right. And the kinds of folks that you get that apply for this, what's the range of professions they come from, age and the like?
So they're usually from a science or engineering background or a medical background, and they typically have an adventurous attitude. Most of them want to be astronauts, so that's part of it as well. They skew young. But that's not really surprising. They're typically of about the age that you would select an astronaut, whereas the age that you would send an astronaut on a long-duration mission is typically older, sort of in their 40s. So that is one issue with our study. But they are, generally speaking, of the type of person that that NASA would select to be an astronaut.
And describe for us the high seas simulation. What is it like? Where is it located? And what sorts of things are people able to do while they're in the program?
So it's a small habitat, about 1,000 square feet, a geodesic dome on the side of Mauna Loa, at 8,000 feet on the side of a shield volcano on the Big Island of Hawaii. The area around it is very Mars-like. Geologically, it's like a young Mars. So lava flows, lava tubes, very little plant or animal life, no visible signs of human activity. They're operating under very Mars-like conditions. So, for example, their communications are delayed by 20 minutes each way to simulate the amount of time it takes for a signal to travel between Earth and Mars. They can't go outside without putting on spacesuits. All their food is shelf-stable. Their use of water is very limited. We allow them 8 minutes of shower time per person per week. And our crews are very astronaut-like in that sense as well. That's our limitation, but most of the crews have pushed that shorter to, say, 4 minutes per person per week, and some crew members do without showers entirely. Now, that's not to say they don't clean themselves, but they clean themselves using wipes rather than water falling on their heads. So it's a decent simulation. Some things we don't simulate are the lower gravity. There's no way to do that on Earth, and they're not subject to dangers like radiation, again, because there's no way to do that, at least ethically.
Yeah, ethically, that wouldn't work. Yeah, you could do it, but it would be wrong. We're talking with Kim Binstead, professor at the University of Hawaii and founder of High Seas, the Hawaii Space Exploration Analog and Simulation. Also with us, a former crew member of High Seas Mission 5 of last year, Brian Ramos. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
No, thank you for having me.
What was the biggest challenge you and your colleagues faced in doing this?
The biggest challenge tends to be, you know, balancing your personal relationships and your work relationships. Because during the mission, we can't separate those two things. The people that you go to work with are going to be the same people that you come home to and you're cooking dinner for or eating dinner with. And so, you know, any type of conflict or disagreement that might happen in your personal life feeds directly into your work life and you know, so on and so forth. So because of that feedback loop, you have to get very good at addressing things quickly and also compartmentalizing them when they need to be compartmentalized.
Some people might think of, you know, like the reality show Big Brother and that sort of thing, which is designed to enhance conflict. Yours is designed not to have conflict. But what are some of the other differences in your living situation last year from, say, a, you know, reality show version?
Oh, well, I mean, you know, for the high seas, we all kind of go in there, as Kim had mentioned, with the idea that we're going to be going in as a crew, really trying to get a lot of research done. So throughout the day, we're working on research projects from the morning to the afternoon. We're going out, we're doing geological studies. So it's, you know, it is a serious research project, something that we dedicated a lot of time to. And then we have those, you know, those different aspects, such as the 20-minute communication delays. You're learning how to work with people, you know, quote unquote, on the ground through those delays, problem solving with that, and just trying to figure out how to tackle those added challenges.
And what about the interpersonal relations? Is there, how did you handle conflict?
Well, that depended. I mean, we were pretty good as a crew. Sometimes it's a matter of, you know, pulling someone aside and having that difficult conversation. Sometimes you have to put those issues aside. So, for example, if we're out, you know, going to explore one of these lava tubes and you might be standing near, you know, a pit that's pretty deep and you have to be focused. So you have to put personal issues aside and address them later. And, you know, the other thing is that a lot of the people that go on these missions are people that want to fly into space. And so they're not people who like to complain, who like to be viewed as complaining. So you have to kind of create opportunities for them to feel comfortable in bringing up an issue so that you can address it as a team. And we tended to do that pretty effectively.
Do you think that the kind of person who applies for and is approved for a project like this is a little bit able to compartmentalize the kinds of things you're talking about than the rest of us? Is that a skill set that's necessary?
I certainly think that's a skill set necessary for, you know, operational work, for people who are going to actually be going to Mars and going to space. I think a lot of us that apply are also used to, you know, we're comfortable with being outside of our comfort zone in things like, you know, only 8 minutes of showering a week and adjusting to a different way with communicating with the world and doing without social media and, you know, constant connectivity to family and being able to pick up a phone and talk to somebody at any moment. So we tended to be people that, you know, like to go out and maybe go to different countries, try something new. And so, you know, I think that's where the adventurous kind of part comes in.
After having this experience, do you think that the stressors of this, the human element of a mission to Mars, could be effectively dealt with?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you have to pick the right crew. You need to have people, in my opinion, that are, you know, have a diverse skill set, but are also dedicated. So they have to be dedicated to the mission and dedicated to the relationships. If you have people that, you know, both individuals want a relationship to work, work relationship to work, you can overcome everything. If you're both on the same page of, hey, you know, even if we're butting heads, we both want this to work. We're going to try to figure out how you can get past that. So, yeah, I think there are certain traits that are going to be really important.
All right, Brian Ramos, thank you for being with us. He's a member of the crew of last year's High Seas Mission Number 5. Professor at the University of Hawaii, Kim Binstead, is the founder of the High Seas Program. It's an annual NASA-funded Mars mission simulation in Hawaii to try and learn what the challenges are for humans in being isolated for an extended period of time with limited resources while also conducting the kinds of research projects that astronauts might be called on should we ever put humans on Mars. Also, thanks to Christopher Edwards, Northern Arizona University professor of planetary science. Coming up on Air Talk, we continue with a look at our Earth and the whole battle over water and land that's depicted in the film Chinatown. How close to real life was that in the formation of Southern California? We'll talk with the historian for the LA Department of Water and Power in just right after this news update. Great to have you with us this morning on Air Talk. If you just picture me sort of sitting in the dark at the microphone, you'd be shocked to see the array of people that we have in the studio. This may be the biggest crowd we've had in a long time. We have longtime supporter listeners who've joined us to watch the show. We have the whole Air Talk crew here. What do we got? 15 people in here or something. We have to put seats in. Anyway, great to have you with us as a part of our Air Talk audience. Speaking of seats, coming up Saturday night, Theater at Ace Hotel, downtown Los Angeles, Chinatown, part of our Film Week screening, movies that are set in Los Angeles. We've shown several of them so far. Chinatown is the next one, that 1974 classic. Well, the gentleman who joins us for the rest of Air Talk today actually went with the screenwriter of Chinatown, Robert Town, to show him much of the history of Los Angeles when it comes to water and William Mulholland and the aqueduct and the development of the San Fernando Valley, to provide some historical underpinnings for Chinatown. But it is, of course, a movie. It's not a documentary. It's not pure history. With us to talk about Chinatown, how much of it is reflective of L.A. and the water wars, and how much is Hollywood, is Fred Barker, retired municipal water engineer for the L.A. Department of Water and Power. He worked there for more than three decades, and he's, you might say, the unofficial historian of the L.A. DWP. Fred, good to have you with us.
I'm very glad to be here, Larry.
Thanks so much. So, first of all, are you a fan of the film, even if it's not strictly historic?
Absolutely. I would say it's one of my favorite three movies that
really?
I've ever seen, yes.
For me, it so captures the sense of the era, even if it's not in every detail truly as it was.
Well, the era it's set in is the 1930s, the Seabiscuit era, but the actual events that are sort of the foundation of the movie took place much earlier, about 30 years earlier. So it's not the same era. The movie is not the same era as the actual events that it's based on.
So share with us, actually, you know, the whole L.A. aqueduct and the construction of it. How much of this was kind of, you know, shady going on and keeping secret that parcels were being bought up in the Central Valley?
Well, the valley that was being where the land was being bought was the Owens Valley,
yeah.
Eastern California. Fred Eaton, in particular, was buying options on land starting about 1903 or 1904 with the idea that L.A. would need the water and would be able to afford to build an aqueduct from the Owens Valley all the way to Los Angeles. So he was buying options that he was either going to own himself or turn around and sell later to the city of L.A. And both of those things happened. Some of them he sold, some of them he held on to for decades.
Now, given all the different lakes in California, what convinced him that Owens Lake would be the best possible water source for Los Angeles?
Well, it wasn't the lake itself. It was the river above the lake. Once the water in the river got into the lake, it became alkaline and unusable, salty and alkaline. So it was above the lake, Owens Lake, where the aqueduct starts, where the water is still fresh. But he knew that because of the elevation and the topography between that point and Los Angeles, that an aqueduct, a gravity flow aqueduct, could be built the entire way. And so he had his eye on that from the 1890s. And it wasn't until 1907 that the city actually had the money to start building the aqueduct.
Did the city have it on its radar, though, or was it these land purchases that got the city thinking, well, maybe this is a good idea?
The city was already looking for more water. The LA River, its main source of water up until that time, was not enough as the city was growing. So they were already looking around Southern California for more water. Fred Eaton, having been born in Los Angeles, knew that that would come to pass where they would need more water. So he took Mulholland up to the Owens Valley in 1904 and told him, this is the city's future water supply. And Mulholland had never been there. And he probably said to Fred, are you nuts? We're hundreds and hundreds of miles away. And Fred said, don't worry, we can do it by gravity. And Mulholland became convinced right away.
So, you know, jumping forward decades, at what point does the Colorado River get identified by Metropolitan Water District as a major source?
It wasn't the Metropolitan Water District that first laid its eyes on that for Southern California. It was the city of Los Angeles in the early 20s. Even though the aqueduct was only about a decade old, they were already realizing more water still would be needed. As LA grew and grew and grew, they went to the Colorado River and began to scout different routes for it. the Metropolitan Water District was formed in 1928 because the city of L.A. realized this is too big of a project for just us. We need other cities to help us. So it was the city of L.A. first, and then it was the Metropolitan Water District a little bit later.
All right. And so they then got together, got all these different municipalities and to do a joint system where they wholesale water that everybody can buy.
That's correct. 13 cities ended up being the original core of the Metropolitan Water District.
We're talking with Fred Barker, for many years an employee of L.A. Department of Water and Power. His official job wasn't the historian, but he's really taken it upon himself to be the historical voice for LADWP. And if you have questions for him about all the controversies over how water was developed for the city of Los Angeles and surrounding communities, how that affected land development and sales, development of the San Fernando Valley is portrayed in Chinatown, the film. We're at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Now, for residents of Owens Valley, the Eastern Sierra region there, how in the dark were they about what was going on and what LA's plan was?
They were completely in the dark. In fact, at the time that Fred Eaton was buying options on land and water rights, the federal government was looking at that valley as a potential project for the Reclamation Service. And a man named J.B. Lippincott was up there doing the surveying and the hydrographic studies. He was a friend of Mulholland's and a friend of Eaton's, and he actually shared the federally funded information with the city of Los Angeles without telling people. So Fred Eaton sort of pretended to be a potential rancher, and J.B. Lippincott was working for the government, the United States government, but at the same time sharing the information behind their back with the city of L.A. So there was a lot of interest in that valley for the federal project to increase their water supply. But in fact, the main people working behind the scenes were actually looking at L.A. as the eventual benefactor of that water.
At what point did the ranchers and farmers and residents of Owens Valley realize what had happened?
It was in May of 1905. There was about a year's worth of behind-the-scenes stuff going on with people pretending to be who they weren't and so forth. But the L.A. Times actually, by one day, scooped all the other newspapers in Los Angeles. There were about 10 at the time, saying L.A. to get a Titanic River. And that was the day before everyone was supposed to know. But they did it one day early. So it was the middle of 1905.
And how did the residents of Owens Valley respond to that?
Well, they were pretty surprised. They didn't realize. There was some inkling that this was going to happen, but they were very upset and surprised that instead of the water staying there for their benefit, L.A. was going to take it, most of it, and ship it to Los Angeles. So they were not happy.
Not happy. And, of course, that set off a decades-long battle over environmental redress for the Owens Valley because the dry lake bed became a health hazard with all the blowing particulates off the surface of the lake. It had a huge effect on all the properties that were nearby. So L.A. really devastated the Owens Valley.
The removal of the water to Los Angeles has had long, long-term effects, yes. And, in fact, About two decades later, L.A., as it grew, started exporting even more water and buying more land in the Owens Valley. That was the 20s. And that's when the dynamite came out. There was dynamiting. There were attacks on the aqueduct. They were trying to tell L.A. through force, we don't like what you're doing to us.
And at that point, did L.A. send any sort of like law enforcement or anything up there to protect the aqueduct as it's being constructed?
Well, they tried. They did. There were initial attempts that were rebuffed by the valley. The sheriff wouldn't help them. The state wouldn't help them. They said, you brought this on yourself and we're not going to help you, is sort of what happened. But then later there were Pinkerton guards and so forth that were sent up to actually physically keep an eye on the aqueduct so it wouldn't be blown up every night.
Wow. We're talking with Fred Barker, retired L.A. Department of Water and Power engineer, unofficial historian of the LADWP. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722. Chinatown, the film, how much of that accurately depicts L.A. and its water and land wars? How much of it is a fictional license? 866-893-KPCC. I want to remind you tickets are available by visiting kpcc.org/in-person. I'll be back in just 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Fresh Air with Terry Gross coming up next. Marine mammal paleontologist Nick Pyonson joins for a conversation on what you probably don't know about whales, like that they're descended from four-legged creatures the size of dogs who walked on land. Pyonson's new book, Spying on Whales. He joined us on Air Talk several weeks ago. He's a terrific guest. That's coming up. Fresh Air with Terry Gross here on 89.3. Right now, the unofficial historian at the L.A. Department of Water and Power, Fred Barker, who was a municipal water engineer for more than three decades with the Water Department. We're talking with him about the water history of L.A. and how much of that relates to the story that's told in the classic film Chinatown. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Michael in Newport Beach, following up on what we're talking about with all the water bypassing Owens Lake and that becoming a health risk to residents of the Owen Valley because of the flying particulates, wondering, you know, how that's all being remediated now, because residents of the valley did reach an agreement with the agency to try and do restoration.
Yes, that's correct. It was more the air quality regulators who said you have to start taking care of the dust that blows off the lake bed. So the city had to decide what was the best way with the least amount of water to do that, to control the dust. And they've actually used three or four different methods to do that. One is shallow flooding of the parts of the lake bed that blow the most dust. They also tried to plant grass, salt grass, that could survive in that environment. They've put down gravel on parts of it. And the most recent method I'm aware of is plowing the surface to break up the wind speed and prevent the particles from being lifted up. But the city, the water department, has spent over $1 billion on projects to control the dust that blows off the lake bed.
Wow. Decades after that was, I mean, because you got a whole generation of people who lived with that dust.
Yeah, that dust blew for decades and was a health hazard for a long time. About 95 to 97%, I think, of the dust is now controlled.
All right. Fred Barker with us at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page. California writes on the page wanting to recommend Margaret Leslie Davis's book, Rivers in the Desert, about Mulholland and the L.A. Aqueduct. Yes, a terrific one. What about land speculation? You know, Chinatown is about, with the arrival of water, that arid parts of the city, you know, San Fernando Valley, the hottest part of the city, that would be habitable, that agriculture, you know, could be exploited with all of the water there. How much of that is true?
No, it is true. The initial flow of the aqueduct, a lot of it was used for agriculture in the San Fernando Valley. And in 1915, most of the valley was annexed to the city so that they could legally use the water that came down from the Owens Valley. So there is a lot of truth to that.
And do you know anything about, you know, the land speculation, when people started buying up plots in the valley with the expected arrival of water?
Of course, that's one of the key plot elements of Chinatown, was the idea that these guys behind the scenes are buying land that's going to increase in value because of water. And the people that were doing that, some of them did that, bought the land before they knew there was going to be an aqueduct. They bought the land very cheaply. It was a huge area with cheap land. When they found out an aqueduct was coming and water was coming, of course, they were very happy about that. And so they were pleased when the aqueduct arrived and the water arrived. Could I mention,
yeah,
if you want to read a good book about Mulholland, Catherine Mulholland.
His granddaughter.
His granddaughter. Her book is the best book by far. I would recommend that above the book you mentioned.
Yeah, it's a terrific book. It's really, it's outstanding. She's a guest with us on the program talking about her grandfather and also about the devastation when one of his major projects collapsed and hundreds of Californians were killed in the resultant flooding.
You're talking about the failure of the St. Francis Dam in March of 1928. Yeah, that was the kind of the end of his career, William Mulholland's career. His career ended in terrible tragedy. Hundreds and hundreds of people were killed.
Middle of the night.
Middle of the night, and the water went all the way to the Pacific Ocean between Oxnard and Ventura and killed people all the way down to the sea.
Catherine Mulholland's book was William Mulholland, The Rise of Los Angeles. It was published in 2000, and she joined us when that book came out to talk about the legacy of her grandfather. Very, very complicated legacy. And we have a dam, of course, that's named for him, the dam at Lake Hollywood Reservoir. Mulholland Drive, of course, is named for him. But his legacy, Fred, is a mixed one because of the St. Francis collapse.
Yeah, there's a book, another book I would recommend called Vision or Villainy by Abraham Hoffman. The idea is, was building the aqueduct a visionary thing to do or a villainous thing to do? And obviously it has elements of both. The city of Los Angeles benefited greatly from that water supply. It went from 100,000 people to 4 million people. At the same time, the Owens Valley was devastated by losing most of its water supply. So you have both elements in the story. You have heroic things, sort of, and devastating things.
I can't imagine that you wouldn't have a water project, whether it was the Owens Valley one or the water would be brought because of the climate draw, the opportunities for agriculture, all the other things. I mean, look at the booming of Phoenix with the Central Arizona project. I mean, it's just hard to imagine if this hadn't happened, you wouldn't have had something comparable.
No. Well, you probably would have at some point, right? Somewhere else would have lost its water instead of the Owens Valley. That's true. But without water, L.A. has everything. They used to say L.A. has everything it needs except water. And once it got the water, then, you know, the explosion of the city occurred.
Are you surprised that here we are all these years later in Governor Brown's twin tunnels for sending water to Southern California, which the Metropolitan Water District Board has, you know, voted to approve a project, highly controversial. Other water districts have voted against paying for it. That here we are again. This is still the central issue for the state.
Yeah. Well, it's not surprising. As the Southern California area grows and needs more water, then you have to go. You can't get it here cheaply. You have to go somewhere else to get it. So that kind of thing will probably continue for many years to come.
Of course, now we have desalination as an issue that wasn't there at the turn of the century.
Desalination. It's a proven technology. It's just expensive. The water would be a lot more expensive than it is today.
All right. Fred, thank you so much for talking with us about the fascinating water and land development history of Los Angeles, those areas intertwined. Appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks. Fred Barker, the unofficial historian of the L.A. Department of Water and Power, for more than three decades, a water engineer for the city of Los Angeles. As always, we thank you for joining us and hope to see you Saturday night, this Saturday, 7 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, for our next Film Week screening. It's the classic from 1974, Chinatown, Jack Nicholson, Faye Dunaway, John Huston. The screenwriter of the film, Oscar-nominated Robert Towne, will be with us after the film to talk about it, as well as our Film Week critic, Claudia Puig. Tickets are at kpecc.org/in-person. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk.